This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a Dutch probe into the 2014 Malaysian Air disaster over Ukraine raises strong Russian reaction. Escalating Palestinian attacks in Israel lead to more bloodshed. New research to help smokers kick the habit.
There are many studies which show that e-cigarettes, which deliver nicotine, don't actually help a lot of people break their addiction to tobacco or help people get off cigarettes. What happens is they switch addiction.
Country music celebrates a milestone birthday. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. A Dutch-led investigative panel into the crash of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine says the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile fired from a Russian-made Buk missile launcher. Dutch officials announced their findings Tuesday in The Hague, with a partially reconstructed portion of the plane looming in the background. Battered metal fragments collected from the crash site were draped on a metal skeleton, reassembled by the investigators in an effort to determine exactly why the plane crashed into the Ukrainian countryside. The Dutch panel did not assign blame for the July 2014 crash, despite Western suspicions that Russia-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine shot down the plane, mistaking it for a military aircraft. Russia's state-run missile manufacturer Almaz Ante said Tuesday its own investigation indicates that the Buk missile was fired from territory which it says was under control of the Ukrainian government at the time of the accident. Almaz Ante head Jan Novikov also said Russian experts have concluded that the missile believed to have brought down the plane was an older Russian-made model, which is no longer used by the Russian military. VOA's Luis Romero spoke with International Edition host Susan Yaki on details and mysteries from the Dutch findings.
The primary conclusion of this investigation is that the plane was brought down by a Russian-made Buk missile, or I should say a warhead from a Buk launcher. That was the main conclusion of this investigation. One of the things that was not clear and that has not been found by this investigation is who launched it. What we did hear from this Dutch safety board, the chairman said that while it is conclusive that it was a Russian made surface to air missile, there was no light shed on whether it was rebels or Russian forces that actually launched it.
Will there be a criminal investigation to nail this down?
It's too early to say, Susan. At least that is what the Malaysian government is asking for. The Malaysia's prime minister issued a statement shortly after the report was made public, urging strong action be taken against those found responsible. For now, what the Dutch investigation says is that it clearly here, in their opinion, the Ukrainian government knew enough to have restricted airspace for commercial aircraft going in. They said the biggest question they had going into this investigation and throughout the investigation was why a commercial airliner was flying through this zone, even as fighting had been escalating for weeks. They said that the officials on the ground had information that the escalation of the fighting could endanger aircraft, including commercial aircraft. Yet there were scores of commercial flights going through that same exact area that day.
Then how did they explain it? Why were all these planes flying over this war zone?
That is one of the mysteries that this investigation, uncovered and is not simply has not resolved. It said that the information was there, yet no one drew a connection between the fighting and the risk to commercial airliners.
VOA's Luis Ramirez speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. The majority of passengers on the Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur flight were Dutch, but the flight also carried citizens of Australia, Belgium, Malaysia, and Ukraine. Representatives from each of those countries were part of the investigation. The crash killed all 298 people on board. The Twitter world is reacting to the Dutch Safety Board's findings. Social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here with details. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
G, what's the U.S. response to all of this?
Washington welcomed the latest findings. The State Department at StateDPT on Twitter shared a video clip of its deputy spokesman, Mark Toner, leading Tuesday's briefing. It also tagged its spokesperson, John Kirby, in the same tweet and shared his statement. It wrote, "We welcome findings of Dutch Safety Board in final report on Malaysia Airlines flight, hashtag MH17. And like you said earlier, Ray, in the show, the finding shows Russian-made rocket was fired from areas controlled by anti-Moscow rebels.
And Russia immediately denied any involvement in the accident. Mm-hmm. Is that reflected in any way in the Twitter universe?
Oh, very much so. So it seems like Moscow has doubts about the investigation in general, and the Paris-based news agency AFP tweeted this. Hashtag breaking. Russia says it has serious doubts about the aim of Dutch MH17 probe.
And G, what about from Russia's state-owned news outlets?
Same sentiment. So RT, which used to be Russia Today, as you know, also tweeted about Tuesday's findings. But naturally, the tone is a bit different from that of Western media. It sent out this tweet earlier Tuesday. Hashtag MH17 down by outdated book fired from Kiev-controlled area, quoting a defense system manufacturer. RT is on Twitter at RT_com. And China is also showing more cautious stance on the findings. The Chinese state-run news outlet Xinhua News Agency tweeted this. Some MH17 passengers might have been conscious for 1 to 1.5 minutes before the crash. So it's tweeting about the findings, but not necessarily the part that involves Russia.
And before you go, can you tell us about the trending hashtags related to the issue?
Sure, hashtag MH17 is the most widely used, but there's also hashtag justice for MH and hashtag justice for MH17. Back to you, Ray.
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Jerusalem suffered its deadliest day yet Tuesday amid a wave of Palestinian attacks this month, with at least 3 Israelis killed. 2 Israelis were killed when a Palestinian with a gun and another with 2 knives attacked passengers on a Jerusalem bus. Israeli security forces on the scene shot one of the attackers and wounded the other. Elsewhere in Jerusalem, a man crashed a car into people at a bus stop, then got out of the vehicle and began stabbing pedestrians. One person was killed and several were injured. That attacker was also shot. A third attack took place in Ra'anana, just north of Tel Aviv, where authorities said an assailant stabbed a civilian at a bus stop before being subdued by others and detained by police. More than a dozen Israelis were wounded in the 3 attacks. The escalating Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians come at a time of stalemate in the peace process. Robert Berger reports.
Peace talks broke down last year, leaving Palestinians frustrated and despairing of their goal to create an independent state. Israeli analyst Moshe Amirav believes Israel should make the first diplomatic move.
The fact that we don't have a political process will bring more and more violence, and it's up to us. We are the strong one. We are ruling the West Bank and Jerusalem. It's up to us to initiate new ideas and arrangements with the Palestinians.
Israel says it is prepared to return to the negotiating table today without preconditions. But the Palestinians say Israel's expansion of West Bank settlements and its refusal to withdraw to the 1967 borders means there is nothing to talk about. These on-and-off peace talks began in 1993, but Palestinians feel they have nothing to show for it and therefore nothing to lose. Palestinian spokesman Saab Erekat says violence is a natural result of the policies of the Israeli government and the occupation. In the political vacuum, violence is escalating. In addition to the wave of attacks, there have been daily clashes between Israeli troops and Palestinians in the West Bank and on the Gaza border. The situation has raised fears of a third Palestinian uprising. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he will travel to Israel and the Palestinian territories to try to calm the violence. Companies are lining up to be part of the pending Trans-Pacific Partnership. Which countries stand to benefit the most from this historic trade agreement? To find out, we are joined by Alexis Christophers from New York, who spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
On the surface, Jim, China appears a clear loser because it's not part of the 12-member bloc led by the U.S. and Japan. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is meant to deepen economic ties and lower or eliminate tariffs between those countries. But company executives and economists say that despite China's slowing growth, at least in the near term, it's well-armed against harm from TPP. That's thanks in part to its reliance on more domestic consumption. So far, demand at home hasn't quite kicked in to make up for sputtering exports, but there is evidence consumption is becoming a more important growth driver in China. Retail sales grew 10.5% in the first 8 months this year, compared with GDP growth of around 7%. And several industries are now looking for growth primarily at home, including the textile and heavy equipment firms. Further down the road, China could face major hurdles if it remains outside the pact. If implemented, the agreement could make it more difficult for higher-end Chinese industries to break into lucrative markets like the U.S. and will lift competitors like Vietnam and Malaysia, just as rising wages and other costs make manufacturing in China more expensive. Jim?
Alexis, I understand that China's car sales gained some momentum in September. What's the latest?
China's car market managed a mild recovery from a three-month decline as the stock market steadied in September. Sales of passenger cars were up 3.3% from a year earlier to 1.75 million vehicles. Industry watchers expect a recently announced tax break on small car purchases to boost sales in the coming months, but manufacturers and dealers are still under pressure from falling prices. Meantime, Ford will pour nearly $2 billion into smart cars for China, where its sales have been slipping amid industry-wide weakness. Ford is hoping the R&D spending push in China will help it develop smart car features specifically tailored to Chinese drivers. Potential features include allowing drivers to control more car systems through their smartphones and to use their mobile chat functions, especially during those notorious traffic jams. Jim?
Always in the driver's seat with the latest economic news, Alexis Christophers from New York. Thanks, Alexis.
Thanks, Jim.
Business correspondent Alexis Christophers in New York, as you heard, speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Commercial imports of elephant ivory have been banned by national laws and international treaty for decades. But in the U.S., activists are pressing states to pass their own laws to deter the poaching of elephants and rhinos. Correspondent Tom Bonzi looks at efforts in the American West to protect endangered wildlife on the African savanna.
A quartet of special agents and wildlife inspectors from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service arrive at an air cargo warehouse near Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. They're armed not with guns, but with handbooks on African wildlife and power screwdrivers. The federal inspectors want to look inside several wooden crates.
There's a lot of stuff in it.
The manifests say the crates contain trophies from big game hunts in southern Africa.
So this is ivory.
In this case, says Supervisory Inspector John Goldman, it's okay because the tusk belongs to a warthog skull. That's not a protected species. Recent investigations of elephant and rhino poaching in Africa attribute the upsurge in trafficking to demand from China and neighboring Southeast Asian countries. The subject of wildlife trafficking came up when President Barack Obama met at the White House with Chinese President Xi Jinping late last month. A White House list of the bilateral agreements reached during that summit included a promise of action from China to match a previously announced U.S. crackdown on the ivory trade. Some observers say that sales in the United States do not materially contribute to the illegal ivory trade, but wildlife advocacy groups assert the U.S. has one of the biggest markets in the world for ivory, legal and illegal, and that ending demand at home is a key to stopping the slaughter of elephants abroad. And that's where John Goldman and his inspectors come in. The forests and savannas of Africa may seem a world away, but animal contraband does make it all the way to the Pacific Northwest. There are about 3 to 4 interceptions per year of elephant ivory jewelry or carvings, or an improperly imported sport-hunted elephant trophy. This at the Seattle-Tacoma seaport and airport and along the nearby border with Canada.
Yeah, it's not very often that we're finding it, yeah.
But Goldman says there's ample reason to believe this is a legitimate problem.
We're arguably the fourth largest seaport, okay? It's a growing airport. It's a growing region. It's a tremendous affluence here. And all of these things are all point to the potential for greater illegal imports of wildlife and exports.
So it's an issue with federal laws to address it, and inspectors who don't find elephant or rhino products locally very often. Why then do groups such as the Humane Society of the U.S., Wildlife Conservation Society, Natural Resources Defense Council, and others want new state laws against it? The Humane Society's Jennifer Hillman says it sends a message.
Having that much deeper level of enforcement at the state level is going to help overall with the trafficking that's happening intrastate.
And that's the direction New York, New Jersey, and California have gone, banning the sale of virtually all ivory within their states. The Oregon and Washington state legislatures considered similar measures during their sessions earlier this year, but those didn't pass. Opposition came from knife and gun enthusiasts. Wildlife advocates are taking their campaign directly to voters with ballot initiatives in Washington State and Oregon. They make no bones about seeking a broad ban on ivory sales, no matter its provenance. The activists argue the legal ivory trade provides cover for sales of illegal trinkets and carvings. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
If you're a smoker, this one's for you. Nicotine is highly addictive and is the main reason trying to quit smoking is so difficult. A new study suggests mandating the sale of only very low nicotine cigarettes may actually help people kick the habit. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
In some countries, upwards of 50% of all men smoke cigarettes or use another tobacco product. And experts say roughly half of them will die of cancer from the deadly habit. That adds up to approximately 20 billion deaths worldwide this century. But there's evidence that a national policy significantly reducing the allowable amount of nicotine, the addictive substance in cigarettes, might help smokers quit. U.S. researchers recruited more than 800 smokers at 10 sites across the country. The participants didn't know it, but some were given very low nicotine cigarettes while others smoked their usual brand. At the end of 6 weeks, those who smoked regular cigarettes with an average amount of addictive nicotine lit up between 22 and 21 cigarettes per day. But those who smoked cigarettes containing a fraction of the amount of nicotine, an average of 30% less than that found in the average cigarette, smoked 14 to 16 cigarettes a day, a reduction of 5 5 cigarettes smoked per day. Smokers who got the lower nicotine cigarettes did not feel the usual withdrawal symptoms, and some even went on to quit. An article published in the New England Journal of Medicine bolsters the case for regulating nicotine as a path to help quit smoking. Tobacco researcher Michael Fiore was not involved in the study, but wrote a commentary in the journal.
Way back in 1976, a early and famous tobacco researcher said the following: people smoke for the nicotine, but they die from the tar. And that tar results from burning tobacco. Thus, if we could somehow disassociate these two and wean people off deadly tar, then we could prevent tens of millions of deaths over time.
The idea of marketing cigarettes containing very low nicotine is intriguing to David Tinkelman, medical director of health initiatives at National Jewish Health in Denver, Colorado. But he notes that cigarette replacements, such as electronic or e-cigarettes, in which smokers inhale water vapor laced with nicotine, have not reduced nicotine addiction or tobacco use.
There are many studies which show that e-cigarettes, which deliver nicotine, don't actually help a lot of people break their addiction to tobacco or help people get off cigarettes. What happens is they switch addictions. They're just taking it a different way.
Both men agree more studies are needed to demonstrate the effectiveness of cigarettes with low nicotine in helping smokers kick the habit. But the White House isn't waiting. In 2009, President Obama signed a law giving regulators permission to require that only cigarettes with very low nicotine levels be sold in the United States. The Food and Drug Administration has yet to act on that authority. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, a birthday bash for country music. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
As of October 1st, 2015, smoking in cars while children are present has been banned in the United Kingdom. Other European countries may soon follow suit. Researchers at Newcastle University say the results of their new study show that smoke toxicity levels can rise dramatically inside a car in just a short time. Lead researcher Anil Nandeo.
The peak level a child exposed to. And we found that this peak could be up to 100 times higher than the safe recommended limits.
Namdeo adds that he considers that no level of smoke inside a car is safe for a child. Jo Harding is pregnant and pleased that her child won't have to breathe in secondhand smoke.
I don't want to be exposed to it as a pregnant person, but I don't want to expose to it as a non-pregnant person either.
Researchers say that the still developing respiratory systems and brains of children are especially susceptible to the effects of tobacco smoke. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. A legendary country music show in Nashville, Tennessee, just celebrated its 90th birthday. VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins International Edition Sarah Williams to talk about the milestone.
Well, if you've heard of legends such as Loretta Lynn, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, many of these country music icons' work has been promoted to the world via a radio show called the Grand Ole Opry. Well, now this small radio show grew into a major concert venue and cultural institution. It celebrated its 90th birthday with all of the big stars in country music. VOA's Nikki Strong is here to talk with us about it. Nikki, how did it get so huge?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was a small radio show back in 1925, and it was founded by George Hay. And it was a live radio show that featured performances from different country artists. It still airs on WSM AM, which had a huge signal, and it enabled the show to reach an exponentially large audience beyond Nashville, Tennessee. And in the process, it became a huge player in exposing and introducing the world to country music. And the Grand Ole Opry, as a consequence, is credited with helping to shape and define the actual genre. And in the process, it's become a source of inspiration for anyone who wants to perform in country music. Reba McEntire, who said she went to a Grand Ole Opry performance before she was a teenager.
Yeah.
And she saw it and said, I want to do that. And look where she is now. So it's been incredible. And Grand Ole Opry has become the pinnacle of a lot of country artist careers. To be inducted and asked to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry is like being inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's selective, it's elitist, and it's a huge, huge honor.
And now it's moved around a lot, too. It's had 6 homes in 90 years.
Yeah. I think by the time I'm 90, I probably will have moved about 6 times at least as well. It has had 6 homes. At first, it was at the National Life and Accident Insurance Company back in 1925. And then it moved several times between 1934 and 1943. It landed at the Ryman Auditorium before it actually settled into its current Grand Ole Opry House in March 1974. I think one of the cool things about it is that when it moved from the Ryman to its current location, a 6-foot circle of oak was cut from the stage at Ryman and inserted into the new stage at the Grand Ole Opry. So by preserving a piece of the Ryman stage, generations of country music singers can perform on the wood where their legendary predecessors
and performed.
Stood.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
A lot of memories there.
Yeah.
Well, is it just country music artists that have performed at the Grand Ole Opry?
No, actually, I mean, it's primarily a country music venue. That is its claim to fame, and that's where it's committed. But actors and actresses and other singers as well have graced the stage. President Richard Nixon, actually, was at the Grand Ole Opry, as well as actor Kevin Bacon, James Brown, Stevie Wonder, Kevin Costner, Robert Duvall, just to name a few.
Yeah, a variety of performers.
Yes.
Visitors there, yeah.
Yes.
Well, you can reach Nikki Strong on Twitter at @VOA_music and on Facebook at VOA Music. You can also hear her on VOA's Country Hits USA. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Elvira. Elvira. My heart's on fire. Elvira.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States believes that the rights to freedom of expression and assembly are rights that all people should enjoy, online and offline. Americans and people around the world, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power, have a tremendous amount to gain from a free and open internet, from the broader sharing of information and ideas to more markets for businesses to a more transparent and accountable government. The internet plays a critical role in supporting democratic activity of non-governmental organizations and individuals. During a recent UN General Assembly event on internet freedom, Ambassador Power noted that there is significant correlation between governments that use the internet to repress their own citizens and NGOs, and those same governments using the internet to launch cyber attacks on other countries and to hack the websites of foreign nationals and companies. During that event, in recognition of the importance a free internet plays in safeguarding human rights, Ambassador Power announced a new initiative called LIFT, Leading Internet Freedom Technology Initiative. The goal is for LIFT to foster innovative next-generation technologies to circumvent internet censorship. The U.S. is launching LIFT with a $10 million investment this year, raising its annual support for internet freedom to $33 million. The potential impact of these new technologies really can be profound, said Ambassador Power. They have the potential to make the internet inherently more resistant to control. These new technologies could help millions of users gain access to the global internet free of censorship. They complement the United States' support of secure communication technologies, as well as its broader support for civil society development and the digital and physical safety of human rights defenders. The United States cannot undertake this task alone. More governments should consider joining the Freedom Online Coalition and the Open Government Partnership. In addition, technology companies should embrace the UN guiding principles on business and human rights. These companies are also uniquely positioned to leverage their own technological innovation in order to preserve the free and open internet. It's important to remember that history is on the side of freedom. every previous effort to destroy or curb new technologies enhancing freedom of speech, said Ambassador Power, have eventually failed. So even as repressive governments are pouring resources into trying to control the internet, the odds and time favor freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.